Hello and welcome to our podcast, Baby Baking and Kid Raising, hosted by myself, Eliza Carr, a passionate midwife, new mama and founder of Bump and Bub, as well as my co-host, Dr. Joseph Scorry, an obstetrician, gynecologist and fertility specialist, as well as a dad of three. Together, we will be discussing topics from fertility through to parenthood and everything in between. Each week, we will be joined by inspiring guests who share their own journeys through fertility, pregnancy, birth and parenthood, as well as educational episodes from us, a midwife and an obstetrician. Today's sponsor is EcoStore. Today we have the privilege of sitting down with the beautiful Monica Rad. Monica is mama to Luca and pregnant with her second little babe. She is a psychology graduate and former Miss Universe Australia. When I first heard Monica's birth story, I remember telling her, even for a midwife, this is a wild story. And today we're lucky enough to hear all about it. So welcome to the podcast, Monica.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
We're so excited to jump into your beautiful birth story, but also a bit of your background, which I just think is so fascinating. So can we start with you telling us a little bit about yourself, your family, and where you live?
Absolutely. Well, I was actually thinking about this. I knew there'd be an intro, so I thought, why not start from the beginning? I was born a Frank Breech. So
there you go.
Yeah, okay. My mum had a nice surprise. I was welcomed into the world very surprisingly, but, you know, vaginal birth back in Bosnia, which is where I was born.
Amazing.
And then when I was 1.5, the war broke out in former Yugoslavia. So we fled, lived in Denmark as refugees for nearly 2 years, and then came into Australia, thankfully. So, yeah, it was a wild story. I mean, look, I was too young to really comprehend what was going on, but for my parents, definitely it was a very challenging time. But lucky enough to be raised in Sydney, you know, I had a normal, great childhood, have a little brother. And then when I graduated high school, I went down the psychology path, as you mentioned, thought that would be my career and that's what I'd be doing. But after a really intense honors year, I thought I'd give myself a break, you know, just a 1 year gap. And then that actually took me down a whole new career of modeling that I was able to do full time and really sort of travel the world and meet lots of new people that I never thought I'd be able to do. So I continued that. That turned into Miss Universe Australia. And then now I'm still on this kind of, I don't like to use the term influencer, but, you know, my social media is what I do for a living. And that gives me the opportunity to be with my son full time. So I get to, you know, be with him and enjoy him as well as sharing the things that I love on my platform.
Amazing. That's incredible. I mean, it's just, you know, even 5-10 years ago, like it wasn't a career path, right? It's absolutely amazing. So do you remember anything about coming to Australia, or were you too young? Like, I know you mentioned to me earlier, you know, your mom and dad came over speaking no English. Do you remember much of that or not really?
I have lots of stories they both told me, you know, but what I remember most is just being with them. When we were in Denmark, living there for nearly 2 years, I had my parents both full time. We were living in a one bedroom. That was our home. We had to share our bathroom with the other refugee families. So I think, if anything, I just had this extreme bond and secure attachment with them because I just knew they'd always be there. But in terms of hardships, I was really shielded by them. I mean, like you said, they couldn't speak the language. We had nothing to our names. We had to leave everything behind. They didn't have time to sell anything. So we had no money. But the government, the community helped us so much. And I mean, to think where I would be if I was still there compared to the opportunities I've been given living in Australia, it's just chalk and cheese, and I'm forever grateful to them and their resilience. That's what they've taught me, I think, through their experience, you know, learning a new language, starting a whole new life. My mum, she was a lawyer in Bosnia, completely redundant here. So she started from the bottom up, you know, started a whole new life for herself. So I think just taking on like whatever life throws at us, you've got a choice whether, you know, you wallow in it or you do something about it and start afresh.
Amazing.
It is one of the things, like when my son, who's in year 7, had to do a bit of a speech in front of this school about courage. And one of the things we remarked on was the fact that, you know, in Australia, all our immigrants, and in actual fact, our Indigenous people, have all sort of had a huge amount of courage to fight adversity, to live not only on the land, but also to come from faraway lands to our nation. And you know, you think about the courage that possibly Eliza and certainly my grandparents did, coming across from Italy, leaving their country to find a better life. And in the same way, your parents as well. I think the notion of, we've talked about resilience before, and the notion that resilience teaches us that the world is generally speaking quite hard and that we've got to fight that hardship. But in actual fact, it's really the courage and the fortitude to make a better life for themselves and to see not only themselves prosper, but the future generations of their children and grandchildren. I think that's a testimony to your parents. Do you remember your first few days, weeks, months, years in Australia? How old were you, did you say, when you arrived in Australia?
I was 4. And in the first month that we arrived, my mum actually gave birth to my younger brother. So she fled, she was flying here, 8 months pregnant. I had to lie, I guess, to be able to get her on the plane. So I remember, you know, meeting a whole new sibling and, you know, being excited about that. And then I started school. So we landed on the 11th of the 11th, and then I started school in January. So I remember a lot about primary school and, you know, my kindergarten years and just meeting new friends and things like that. But otherwise, it's just my parents' stories.
You often get punctuated by events in your life. So, you know, my little daughter, my 17-year-old daughter, we shifted to Bangkok for a little bit and then Sydney. And so she's got these sort of, even though she was quite young, she can remember certain events. I'm just interested in to know, what was your impression of Australia as a 4-year-old? Like, were you told there were going to be kangaroos in the streets?
I don't remember, but my parents have told me that when we landed on the tarmac and it was really, really hot, and I was like, is it going to be like this every day? So it must have been a super humid day that day. No, but I think I was too young to probably even comprehend what Australia was and the characteristics that we're always, you know, labeled as from other countries. No, I was super young. But I do, the local Anglican church was giving us lots of things, lots of secondhand clothes and toys and things. And when my mum went into labor, I didn't care about going to see her in the hospital. I was like, let's go to church. Like, I want some toys today.
That's amazing. It's also just incredible, like you said, Joe, about the courage, but it's incredible what you will do to forge a future for your children and a better future than what, you know, you're looking at. And then you have children and everything changes. And like you, Joe, my grandfather came and your parents, Monica, came over on a boat from Egypt when he was young, and landed, not a word of English. And just now he's built this incredible family. There's so many of us because everyone has lots of children. But it's this incredible thing to come from, nothing and grow to such a beautiful family and grow, you know, successful in your own way. And yeah, so thanks for sharing that with us. I think that's beautiful. And do you think that that's played into your motherhood role with your little boy?
I think it's played into my life in every aspect, in every way, shape or form. Like, you know, one thing that sticks out in my childhood is I was so embarrassed that we lived in an apartment. And I just couldn't understand. I was like, why can't you guys just buy a house? Like, they actually saved and they were able to buy their own place, which is so huge for someone that's, you know, started from nothing. And I was like, why? It's just an extra $200,000-$300,000, buy a villa. Like, I was so, you know, as a silly teenager. And then now when I think back to all those things, like, my God, the fact that they could provide food on the table and we never went without. I always had the best of the best. You know, they sacrificed everything so I would not feel like the poor child at school, even though potentially we were. And now I just think, like, I mean, my son is so blessed beyond, you know, in every single way, shape or form, when you think about how lucky he's been to be raised in a place where the financial stress isn't there, that it was so much for my parents, and the uncertainty. So I think it's just being grateful. That's what it's taught me, just to be so grateful for every single thing I've got now, thanks to them and their sacrifices.
How do you think you will sort of instill that in your son, like the fact that there is the need to be grateful? I mean, I struggle with the notion that, you know, I grew up in a very privileged society and a privileged life. My dad was a pharmacist. We lived in a good house. I went to a private school, but yet I was still taught the lessons that my grandfather told me. You know, he didn't have shoes until he was 11, and, you know, he had to be in the fields picking tomatoes and you know, from the ground, and, you know, having a sore back at the end of the day. There was that, but there was a tangible link between me and him. I find it very difficult with a, you know, 13 and a 17-year-old child who basically get everything and anything they want, to sort of impress upon them that it's just not that easy. How do you, I mean, you're effectively a first generation Australian, having lived here for the first time. How do you think you're going to sort of instill that into your son and future child?
I mean, I would actually love your advice because I'm now in the throes of a two-year-old who every time we go to the shopping center, he's like, let's go over there and buy some toys. Mama, you go pay. And it's like, it's so hard to, firstly, do you know, you pick your battles. Do we have a tantrum today when I explain no toys today? And then he, you know, it's going to be an extra half an hour's worth of waiting and, you know, patting him to calm him down. Or do I give in and give him the, even if it's a $10 toy, it's not about the money, obviously. It's about, you know, being grateful for receiving something, which I receive twice a year for Christmas and my birthday. And so I'm really in the thick of it, trying to figure out how to do that because I definitely want him to grow up with the same sort of backbone that I had, thanks to my parents and thanks to just knowing the value of a dollar because we didn't have a dollar. So I had to, we really had to learn the value of it. So please, what have you done with your kids like?
Well, it's interesting you say that because we've also got a four-year-old daughter and even yesterday we went to a place to eat and Isla loves to pay. She must think my phone is something magical because she'll sit there with the phone.
Endless supply.
And I said to her, you know, where's that come from? Like, what are we doing there? It, no concept. It is difficult. And I think, you know, as much as I try to say to them, you know, that there is this past generation that had to fight hard to get to where we are now, it is very difficult. And I find it exceptionally difficult because I said to my son, you know, what do you aspire to be? Where do you see yourself, you know, in 10 or 15 years' time? And he, you know, did he want to be in a place that was very similar to where we are now? Did he want to be better than where we are now? And there was just this element of apathy. Not that I'm picking on him a little bit, but he's also only 13. So it is really difficult trying to navigate that process and try to see, get him to see that you do have to strive hard to where you get to. I think part of it also is, you know, our 17-year-old went to work. She understands the value of a dollar. She knows that sort of, you know, took her X amount of time to earn that so that she can afford Y. So I think that there's elements there that she understands the concept and the value. I think that's the difficulty. And when you start teaching that, I don't know, but I think that's the most important thing.
Absolutely. I actually heard a podcast with Miranda Kerr recently and obviously heard her husband's a billionaire. I'm sure she's not far off. And for her children, when they want something, when their friends have got a new toy, she says, that's great, darling. Let's put it on your birthday or Christmas list. And they don't buy them presents until it's birthday or Christmas. And I thought that is a great tactic. I mean, I don't know how effective it'll be if you can try now with yours since they're a little bit older, but I'm going to try and incorporate that.
I can imagine Miranda Kerr's children have a very extensive birthday list then.
I believe so. But at least you're not fighting every single day for buying the new things that they want. It's twice a year, whatever. Go for it.
Stuart and I have chatted about this a lot. And as you know, he's from South Africa. And well, for us, it's travel. And I mean, I know it's a very entitled thing to say because travel is expensive in its own right. But we took Zadie to 8 countries in her first like 7 months of life. And we were like, and obviously she's not going to remember it, but that's for that, for us, that was what is so important. You know, you land in South Africa and immediately you see immense poverty. There's a 50% unemployment rate. Like, you know, you just see poverty everywhere. And for us, that's how we plan to, you know, show Zadie, you know, just how fortunate she is.
It's interesting you say that, Eliza. I've, you know, I had this notion, unfortunately we've not done it, but I had this idea maybe 10 or 15 years ago to actually go and work in a village, you know, build the well or whatever the case might be, so you actually can see that and palpably taste what's going on with people who have virtually nothing, but more importantly are so happy. I think that's a difference. We live in a society where we get everything that we want and yet a lot of us aren't happy, and the mere fact that we get food on the table and we've got clean water is a necessity for many people and yet they don't have it.
Oh, absolutely. We like even just the gratefulness that is, yeah, because we have such an instant gratification in terms of our society, right? We're all in Australia, most of us have some money to spend. We have some disposable income. And even in South Africa, we were there a few months ago and we gave all of Zadie's clothes away to the beautiful lady that works with his family. And she has a lot of grandchildren and she was so grateful for these clothes. They were just like Bonds onesies, zip suits. And she was talking about how she would work that month to pay for, you know, even half of that amount of clothes, and just the gratefulness that you can, and it's almost selfish in a way because you're giving and you're just thinking, holy moly, this is filling up my cup. Like to see people that are just so beautiful and grateful for even just the smallest of things. Anyway, let's steer back on to your can you tell us a little bit about your pregnancy, the model of care you chose?
Yeah, definitely.
How your pregnancy was with Luca and now with your second little bubba.
By the way, is Luca with a C or with a K?
With a K, because I'm Monica with a K.
And also, yes, okay, fair enough, yes.
You know? You got to do some kind of tradition, don't we?
Absolutely.
And you say his name so beautifully. Can you say it?
I say it beautifully.
You say his name so beautifully.
Luca.
Yeah, well, it's Luca. So much more beautiful than the Australian.
Luca. Well, you know, I say it both ways, but Luca is the sort of way that comes to me naturally.
Well, it's Italian as well, Luca, we say.
It
Luca.
Is.
But I call my son Luke's.
Oh, is your Luke. What's your son's name?
Luca.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but with a C.
With a C, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, Luke's, that's cute. I call him Lukey right now, but I'm sure he's going to hate that. Luke sounds a lot cooler for a cute little preteen.
Absolutely.
Oh, good. It's a beautiful name. I think we chose well.
You did. You both did.
Well, tell us, going back to what Eliza said, tell us a little bit about, you know, that the first pregnancy with Luke's.
Sure. All right. Well, good old Luke's. Well, basically, for me, I'm a real nerd at heart. And when I want to know about something, like, I just dive right into the research. So probably about a year before I even thought about falling pregnant, I started to dive deep into pregnancy and birth and the different models of care. And I don't even know how I came across it, but home birth came on my radar. I think I watched a few documentaries actually. And then it just something inside me felt, wow, this seems amazing and something that I'd really like to do. So I did further research. And then when I fell pregnant, I think I found out at about 4.5 weeks, like in 2 or 3 days, I was calling midwives, private midwives, to book them in because I just needed to be ready to
organized.
Yeah. And I was stressing even at that time because my due date was the 29th of December. So I was really mindful. It's Christmas and New Year period. Like, hopefully there's going to be someone that's still on call and happy to take me on. So I did. I locked in my wonderful midwife. Her name's Jo Hunter. And that was about 6 weeks, I found a doula because I felt like I would love to have that emotional support, especially for my first birth. Didn't really know what to expect. And I just would, you know, love the idea of having this kind of cheerleader that really was looking after me and my mental well-being and everything else. And also to help my husband. And I've heard from a lot of people that have had a doula, and I can definitely speak for that, is that the most valuable thing is for your husband to have, or your partner, should I say, to have someone that's actually supporting them as well, because it is a really frightening, unnerving, you know, time for first time parents. So I locked those two people in, and that was pretty much.
It's interesting you say that because I work exclusively with one doula who comes. In fact, we celebrated her 50th birth just recently, working alongside me. And one of the things a couple of couples have said, particularly the partners, is why the hell aren't I, you know, why do I need a doula? Why do we need a doula? Here I am supporting my partner. You know, she's going to go through birth. That's my role. And it's almost like denying them that opportunity to be able to care for their partner in labor. But what I always say to them is, in actual fact, both of you need an element of care during the whole birthing process. And the doula really provides an element. Well, you know, the midwife and the doctor, they'll focus on the woman giving birth, but you actually need someone to look after the partner as well, particularly males who haven't been involved in the whole process of childbirth up until recently.
Oh, without a doubt. And I mean, just seeing your partner in pain, you want to be there to sort of comfort them. But then for my husband, I've spoken to him about it after. And like for him, you know, seeing that pain, it's like that red flag in their minds. Like, how can I help? This is wrong. She shouldn't be in pain, even though it is a physiological part, normal part of it. So by having a doula that looks at the partner with the sort of calming eyes, like, she's okay, she's got this. God, it just puts them at ease as a partner. So, I mean, gosh, for us, it was absolutely invaluable. And when you hear my actual birth story, you'll understand why, that the doula was such an integral part of keeping both of us calm at the end of it. So my pregnancy, though, in saying all this home birth stuff, I mean, it's really important to pick the place that you feel the most safe to give birth. So I would never, ever advocate for a home birth for somebody that, for them, that seems like the most dangerous place, you know. So obviously everybody should do their own research. But for me, it was really ringing true that that was the place that I'd really want to give birth. And my pregnancy, knock on wood, it was just an amazing, easy pregnancy. I was healthy. Baby was healthy. I didn't have any symptoms until the end, where sciatica played a big part. I could hardly walk for the last few weeks. But apart from that physical pain, there was nothing else that really went wrong in the pregnancy. So fast forward to the 31st of the 12th, so New Year's Eve, I woke up with some cramping about 6 a.m. And then I got up and I felt some water gush out. So I knew, okay, my waters have slightly broken. Sent a picture to my midwife. She confirmed it and said, just go about your day. So the plans were, it was COVID. So it was 2020, December 2020. And we were having, I think it was like six people. It was a limited six people to a celebration for New Year's Eve. So we had six of our friends in our neighborhood and we were having a New Year's Eve dinner and I was in charge of the dessert. So I went about my day and I baked the dessert. And, you know, documented on Instagram. No one else knew what was going on, but I was like, you know, really excited inside. And then just the water just kept gushing out. I ended up having to wear nappies the whole day because I couldn't control it with just a pad, but no other symptoms, no other cramping or contractions in sight. And then about 12 or so hours later, just before we were about to leave at around 6 p.m., I started feeling the light period pain and I was like, okay, something's happening. Went to dinner. And then during dinner, I was contracting every 6 minutes and it was for about a minute, but I was able to just have conversation in between. The friends around me were the most uncomfortable because, you know, they just had to stop and watch a woman in labor every 6 minutes. But I honestly was like, I don't know. I felt really relaxed about the whole thing. I don't know. I don't even know why. I think because I did lots of research and I should say, I think I've skimmed over my pregnancy, but I also did a hypnobirthing course. And that really empowered both myself and my husband just with like so much more knowledge about what's going on in birth and why and the sensations and the stages and things like that. And then I also, you know, learned some breathing techniques and some meditations. So all of that really helped my mindset even beforehand. And just, I felt like I could do this. And I think it's really important as a birthing woman to have that confidence in yourself, because if you don't believe in yourself first, it's really hard when the going gets tough during labor for anyone else to encourage you if in your mind you're like already feeling like a failure.
So true.
Yeah. So for me, that was integral in my later stages of labor. So yeah, we were having dinner and then at about 10:30, I had my dessert and everyone was like, go home, Monica. And I was like, I need that dessert because I baked it and I'm really excited about it. So I, looking back, it was a bad decision. I was extremely full during labor, which isn't, I mean, it's not comfortable in any sense of the word, but I just needed that dessert. Got home at about 10:30, 11-ish. And my husband, who had like two drinks or something at dinner, he just probably couldn't comprehend that I was actually in labor. So he was a little bit tipsy and he literally went to lay down. And here I am in the living room on my birthing ball, just, you know, going with the flow. My contractions ended up being 3 minutes apart for about 30 seconds. I spoke to my midwife. I spoke to my doula. This is probably around midnight that I spoke to them both again. They listened to me laboring and they both said, you're doing a great job. It's still very early on though, so we're not going to come. We're going to call you back in about an hour or two to see where you are and then we'll think about coming. Now, my midwife was about an hour away and my doula about 20 odd minutes. And my husband at the time was like, you know, like a little bit nervous about that and thought like we need to have someone here. And I kind of was agreeing with him, but then I also, you know, trusted these people and their experience. And I thought, no, obviously I'm still in super early labor. So, you know, like I'll call them in about half an hour or so, seeing where I'm at. And they both also told me, go get some rest. And that was funny because when they said that to me, I was on the ball just thinking, oh my gosh, like this is going to be a bit of a marathon. How am I going to do this? And little did I know that was actually my transition thoughts, because about 10 or so minutes later, I needed to go to the toilet to do a pee and I'm sitting on the toilet and completely involuntarily, my body starts to push. And the only way that I can describe the sensation is that when you have, you know, really bad diarrhea, your horrible cramps, you know, from gastro or something, and your whole body is saying, like screaming, push, 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 just to get some relief. That's literally what my body did. So without even allowing it, just going with the flow, I felt something come out of me while I was on my toilet, Joe. And I called out to my husband. I knew that it wasn't a head because it didn't feel like huge. And I just, at the time, I thought my vagina was falling out. And I was like, oh my goodness, what is happening here? And then my poor husband got shot out of bed, came over and he just said, it's a foot. And I was like, it's a what? It's a foot. And both of us were just, call Joe, the midwife. We called her and you just hear her, fuck, call an ambulance. Because she was still at home, you see, because I was in early labor. So here I was, on all fours, butt up in the air, as she instructed me, because if anybody was to touch that foot, the startle reflex may start inside and then he'd be stuck, you know, like a starfish. And anyway, so I did that. And then the first thought that went through my mind, you know, after planning this natural home birth was, I'm going to have an emergency cesarean, something that like was the furthest from my mind. But then, you know, that I found myself panicking. And then I also sort of came back again, really instinctively. This wasn't a conscious process, but I stopped the thought. I closed my eyes and I just continued breathing and almost dissociated myself from the situation.
Just important, I think, for people to know that a breech, basically, we know that breeches is basically when the baby's upside down, head's at the top. At the bottom, there can be a footling breech, which is what you're describing, where the first presenting part of the baby is actually a foot. And that's come through the cervix, which is not completely fully dilated. So cervix, we know, you hear about it when you're in birth or birthing classes, it's got to be 10 centimetres to allow the baby to descend. And that's the size of the baby's head. When you've got a footling breech, of course, a foot can get through 2 or 3 centimetres and wheel its way through. One of the things we're concerned about as healthcare professionals is that if the foot's come through and there's not something blocking the entrance or the cervix, a bit like a plug that's sitting, if you imagine a plug that's in a sink and it's just hovering above the plug hole, if you let go of it, it should suck back straight in. Think about cord as spaghetti sitting in and around the water. If something like a little foot has gone down through the plug hole, one of the things we're really worried about is the cord then coming as well. And that's like the spaghetti getting underneath and shooting straight out. But we're also, of course, worried about the baby and how the baby will descend through the birth canal, given the fact that only just one little foot's come through. And of course, the other types of breeches are a complete breech where you've got the bottom and the legs, and then a frank breech, which is where the baby's legs are completely up and it's just the bottom that's sitting in the plug hole, so to speak, or where the cervix is. So this was genuinely, and Joe did a very good thing in telling you to get an ambulance, an emergency, because you know, unfortunately, in some cases, this can end in some difficulty. And I've certainly been involved in one case where it didn't end up too good for the mum and also for the bub. But keep going with your story, because we've had a happy ending. We know that.
We have, thankfully, we have. And that's right. I mean, that was all my concern, because he was presenting head down. I didn't have a late ultrasound, but my midwife, my doula, a friend who's an OB, and my acupuncturist all felt my belly in the last week or two and were like, yep, head down. Like nobody uttered a potential concern. Wait, is that a head? No, they were all convinced. But I think he fooled us because he was breached for a while.
There's actually an interesting study where they put, this is in the UK, they had 100 women go through an antenatal class. And we know that approximately 5% of babies are going to be breached. But they put 100 people through a antenatal visits where there were a combination of midwives, midwifery students, medical students, and also obstetricians who were there to pick whether the 5 women in that 100 were breech, and the strike rate was exceptionally, exceptionally low. In fact, the best people to predict were the midwifery students and the medical students, because they just second-guessed themselves all the time. They were like, oh, no, it feels breech. But they also mucked up a lot of the head ones as well. So they were like, you know, the head ones are breech. And it's because, you know, our hands are pretty good, but really it doesn't, an ultrasound scan is the best thing to be able to see a baby's head or whether it's a bottom. But, you know, we can miss it. And often people will come into labor and they'll have a breech presentation and they'll go, oh, why wasn't it picked up before? It's because it's a hard skill. It is difficult to determine specifically where the baby's lying.
Human error.
Absolutely. And that definitely happened with us. But, you know, in hindsight, everything I felt really did happen for a reason, because I know that if breech was picked up earlier, I wouldn't have had the, I think, option to labor at home. And eventually, so basically at the end of it, my active labor was only 2 hours and 35 minutes or something, which is wild, right, for a first-time birth. And so I think a lot of that had to do with, because, like, I was really enjoying myself at New Year's Eve dinner. I was completely relaxed, and then I came home and just, like, chilled out on the ball. And then, you know, that was a big concern, like you were saying, Joe, because a foot obviously doesn't need the 10 centimetres of dilation. So a big concern when we finally did get to the hospital was that if I'm not fully dilated, there's no way that I can deliver him naturally. So that was the first thing that the midwife on duty called, checked. But back to my sort of story of when I, from the second I sort of found out and I blocked, I dissociated myself, I closed my eyes and I didn't open them until he was out. So that, so he, his foot came out at 107. We were transferred to the hospital. We had actually four ambulances escorting us because it was an exceptionally quiet New Year's morning, you know, COVID time and everything. So they were just all hanging around waiting for an emergency that didn't happen until we came along. And then we got to the hospital at probably, so maybe 135 or 140. And again, a big blessing, the midwife on call or on duty that night, she had delivered so many infants in third world countries, in South Africa, was one of them, she was saying, and she could do anything and everything with her eyes closed. So my doula actually came about 5 minutes before us and was able to prep the team, you know, letting them know my preferences. I would love a natural birth if possible, and that I'm willing to give anything a go if that means that I can deliver him vaginally. And so she did prep them, and the midwife was like, yep, let's do it. If she's dilated, we can do that. And I got to the room. I was told there was about 15 people around watching because it was, again, a quiet New Year's morning and a very interesting, you know, breech presentation. Like, it doesn't happen every day. So everyone wanted to be in the room, I guess, to see it. And my eyes were closed though this whole time. And then, so I basically listened to what this midwife told me. She got on the bed with me. She actually, the reason his one foot was out was because the other foot was stuck up. And that's the reason he didn't come flying out, they told me afterwards. So she freed that foot. And then got on the table and started pushing down my belly to manually stimulate contractions is what I remember being told. Because after his foot came out, I think my body still, even though he was completely calm and my heart rate was probably okay, my contractions had slowed right down. I think with the adrenaline of everything. I definitely wasn't in labor land anymore, you know, going with all the oxytocin. And eventually, in about 8 or so minutes, I had pushed him out. So at 1:57, he was born.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
I know. I still can't believe it. 2.5 years later.
And did your midwife make it to the hospital or no?
5 minutes after he was born.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, but my doula was the one at my head, just really coaching me through it. Even though, to be honest, they all told me after I was a really great student because, and I really am quite a teacher's pet. I've always been like that at school. So I want to deliver. So I entered the room with my eyes closed and I just greeted everyone and apologized for my eyes being closed. But I just want to stay in the zone, guys, but thank you for everything you're doing. And then I just did everything they told me to do. They said, push, I pushed. And I didn't make a sound. My husband actually filmed it. And I've got to watch myself back and I was just, like, listen to them, and I just wanted to get him out, you know, safely. So I just did whatever they told me to do. And he was filming saying, you can do it, you know, horse's breath, which is what I told him beforehand to help me with. And there you go. Baby was out.
Wow. And how did Luca come out? Was he okay? Did he cry when he came out?
He did. He was fine. He had the Apgar scan. The score was perfect. But because it wasn't this, you know, with a home birth, one of the sort of big attractions for me was that after the baby's born, it's just you and the baby and you've got this beautiful, calm connection that you can really soak each other in. And that was the furthest for what happened with me. I was like, what has just happened? And I don't even remember when I first laid eyes on him because I was just, as you can imagine, in complete shock. That's right. But I've got, you know, videos of us afterwards and I've seen, you know, maybe whatever, 5 or 6 minutes later, he was on my chest and we had that beautiful bonding. But it was definitely an experience that I had to come back to myself to relive. I wasn't embodied in the whole process, that's for sure.
Today's sponsor is EcoStore, a brand that I have used for a long time now, especially since falling pregnant and becoming a mama. EcoStore's ethos has always been to put people's health first and give them the choice to live clean whilst also creating incredibly effective products. EcoStore's products are made from naturally derived ingredients, meaning they're safer for us and our families. We know that toxins in our environment play a critical component in the short and long-term health of both ourselves and our children, and I proudly use the EcoStore range. EcoStore has every product that you could need, from home and body care to home cleaning products, right through to beautiful award-winning baby skincare that includes bubble bath, body wash, and shampoo. Their baby skincare and ultra-sensitive range is dermatologically tested for sensitive skin, so you can rest easy knowing that their products are better for you and for our environment. Available from the EcoStore website and major retailers across New Zealand and Australia. See the show notes for more. Joe, is there any correlation between Monica being a breech and then her having a breech baby, or not really?
Probably not, no. I mean, look, it'd be interesting to see what happens with this next little one. I mean, obviously the pelvis has an element of shape to it, and whether the baby, the way the baby sort of nestled, and if your mum's pelvis is the same sort of shape, perhaps that's leading to a breech presentation. But I don't think there's a lot of evidence. I think, you know, you're exceptionally lucky you had someone who'd had caught many babies as a breech presentation. You're also certainly lucky that presumably the cervix was fully dilated, and the only reason that the second leg hadn't presented was basically because there was a bum there and she could easily grab that subsequent foot in order to bring the baby down. Because there's no doubt in my mind, should that cervix have been sort of 3 or 4 centimetres with a foot dangling through, you would have had a cesarean section.
Absolutely.
And it's really difficult. And one of the things we always find difficult in medicine and also midwifery is that consent process. You know, how do you consent someone who's in labour, fully dilated with a breech presentation, when we do know that there are risks and or complications that can happen with a breech presentation? And, you know, I was part of the college guidelines setting up for breech birth, and we do know that, you know, 1 to 1.2% of all breech presentations will end up with some element of badness, for want of a better word, and you can't really consent someone for that. It's the same as, you know, consenting someone for a cesarean section, an emergency cesarean section. We can't truly consent someone for a procedure when they're in the throngs of labour. It's same as rocking up to an emergency with a, you know, gunshot wound or a broken leg that needs to be immediately fixed. You're really trusting the people around you. And fortunately, as I said before, you had someone who was very well skilled and apt at being able to do a breech birth, because there's very few of us that can actually do it nowadays. And, you know, the cesarean section has become the default position for many people when it comes to breech.
I know, and I knew that. And that's why when I heard my husband say the foot is out, that's exactly, I mean, I've done all that research and I knew, and breech wasn't even on my radar. That's why I consider myself like extremely lucky. I just think everything like happened in the best way possible for me and my, you know, my plans. And I also think with home birth, and I spoke openly about it during my pregnancy, and I feel like if I had had that cookie cutter, relaxing, comfortable, quick home birth, people may turn around and say, yeah, okay, but that you were just extremely lucky that there was no complications. What if there was a complication? Then what would you have done? And I feel like I'm really grateful for my experience that I actually got to witness a complication, an emergency, a transfer to the hospital, and experience both sides of it. And I just consider myself very, very lucky. And again, strangely, I'm extremely excited for another chance to do it again. Like that wasn't a trauma-filled experience for me. And I do really attribute that to all the research and the preparation I did beforehand, because I felt empowered the whole time.
Yeah. It's very good. So actually, one thing I did want to talk about, people often get worried that the hospital experience is a sterile environment. And I think you can make the hospital experience as much and as little as you want. And so, you know, in many of the births that I attend where parents are, or mothers are really wanting that sense of immediacy and connection with their newborn, you know, the lights are dim, there's tea candles everywhere, the baby, you know, I and a lot of obstetricians do practice where the mum actually brings the baby up onto their chest and brings baby into the world. And there's that immediacy of skin to skin. And it really is sort of, for want of a better word, that experience that you were desiring in the home setting, but really in a hospital setting. So you can make things as comfortable as you possibly can, even in a hospital setting, like you're saying before, you know. And I have an adage very similar to what you sort of said, which is, you know, every woman's birth experience is unique to her, and no woman should be judged for that birth experience or what ends up happening during that birth. So, you know, all the power to you. So what have we decided this time round in terms of birth and pregnancy?
Pretty much identical to last time. I've got the same midwife, Jo Hunter, and I'm like really hoping that I can have that home birth that I wanted the first time. The only difference this time, Joe said that as soon as I feel any tinge of pain, she's going to be there with, you know, at home.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh.
And look, also an ultrasound scan sort of in the last couple
exactly.
of weeks.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. That too.
Yeah. I think that would be, there's no doubt if you manage to give birth in terms of a breech. I mean, the thing that we're always worried about the breech, you know, generally speaking, the bottom is the same size as the head. And so the diameter from hip to hip is about the same size diameter as the baby's head, but sometimes there can be concerns with the bottom coming out and the head then getting stuck. So, and, you know, look, there's reasons why we need to assess the baby's size in terms of making sure that that's suitable for a breech birth. But the simple fact is that if you had a pretty quick labour last time, chances are you're going to have an exceptionally quick labour next time. And, Joe, you may not even need Joe.
I don't think I'm quite ready for a free birth.
Well, you know what? It could be exceptionally, exceptionally quick. You know what I mean?
Oh, my gosh. So, that's right. That's right. Well, hence, as soon as I feel any tinge, she's going to be there. And now she lives a lot closer, so.
Yeah. I'd actually say, I'd almost suffice to say if that your waters break, she should just be sitting around with you drinking coffee.
Okay, yeah, if that happens first again. But normally that doesn't really happen first a lot, does it, Joe?
No, it doesn't. Some women can go into labour without their waters breaking and other women will go into labour and then, you know, they have their waters broken first. I think I've shared the story of my own wife who basically she was sort of having a similar sort of scenario to you. Every sort of 6 minutes, these little bit of tightenings, and she was sitting on the bed with my sister-in-law, and I came home from work. This is before I did obstetrics and gynecology, and they were saying, you know, every 6 minutes she's having a tightening. And I said, what are you doing there on the bed there? What happens if your waters break? And no sooner has she got up off the bed, like there was a tsunami of water. So, yeah, it can happen before, after. As Eliza can attest, it can also happen if you're at the end of the bed with the woman being examined and then have a mouthful of water. Yeah, that can happen like that too. I remember there was a registrar and she was standing at the end of the bed and I said, look, I wouldn't stand there if I was.
Oh, no.
And then I guess on the flip side is like my experience, I had to have my waters broken at 42 plus bloody weeks. And there was like, is my waters broken? Is it not? Like this tiny little leak of like trying to figure out, are they even broken? So it's just the experience
right.
for each woman is just so vastly different.
Absolutely.
Like you, two hours, me, three and a bit days. Like why? It's wild.
Agreed.
It's a wild.
Do we know the sex of this bubba or is there going to be a surprise?
No, we know. Oh, my gosh. So I want to announce it in some cute way on Instagram, right? Like I think my baby deserves it. But at the same time, I've been very time poor. My husband had a nice idea. He's an artist, you see. So he wanted to incorporate painting with our son and then revealing the gender. And yeah. We haven't done anything like that. And I've told everyone that I know. So I'm going to share it with you guys too. It's another little boy.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah.
Boy mama. I feel like you are a boy mama.
Apparently so. So I was convinced it was a girl, but I think.
You'll have to go the third to have a girl, surely.
You're maybe the 200 that's told me that. But so you've got three, you were saying, Joe.
I've got three. We've got a 17-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son. And then my wife and I went back and we've got a 4-year-old daughter.
Wow.
Yeah, she's awesome. The other two are pretty good too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've seen some very funny gender reveals and there was one that I saw on Instagram where a woman had obviously put something in her bottom and she passed wind and a puff of smoke came out the colour of the
baby. Stop it. Oh, my God.
That's ridiculous.
So if you're thinking about doing something that's unique, you know, there are ways of being able to do that.
Organise something. What can we do? Yeah. I just got to get like a. You could just get a little squeezy though. You can. I'm sure that was fake. Surely that was fake.
I look. You know, I've got a couple of stories. One story is of a Greek family, and you can imagine a massive Greek family. Like there's heaps and heaps of people in this room, and they put about 20 balloons in the air. Obviously, the black ones filled with confetti. And they popped the first one and it was blue. So everyone said, it's a boy. Oh, congratulations. And they were like, yeah, yes, we'll dig at this, whatever, right? Gala, whatever. I don't even know those words because I'm not Greek. But anyway.
I understand. How are you? But good. That's what you've just said. Yeah. How are you? Good.
But then the parents explained, actually, we don't know because there's 20 balloons. You would think there's 10 and 10, you know, they're all blue, but they're not. 11 of them will be one colour and 9 will be of the other. And whatever's the most of the 20, so if we get to 11 blue, then it's a boy, and if it's 11 pinks, it's a girl. So and now you can imagine they were popping these balloons and some of them were pink and some of them were blue. And all the Greeks are sitting there not counting properly. They're going, No, there's been seven blues. What are you talking about? No, there's been seven pinks. What are you? Right, so they were fighting with one another, and no one was keeping count except for one person. And then eventually they worked out that, you know, there was 11 pinks, so it was a girl, right? So that's pretty good. But I actually think there was one thing I would like to do, and I've not heard of anyone do this, but like you're in a pool and you jump into the pool and you release some dye.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be cool.
That'd be great and really easy to clean as well.
Mm. No, you'd have food colouring. It would go through the filter and then come out. Okay.
I'm picturing like paint. I'm picturing paint coming out.
I'm spitballing.
This is what keeps Joe up at night, about how.
Or you could get like bikini or swimwear that changes colour when you're in the water.
Yeah, that's actually a good one.
Thank you.
I like that. Now let's just invent it, hey? Let's just spend X amount of years and money to do that for us.
There's swimwear that changes colour when you go in the water.
Like mood swimwear.
Yes, mood
swimwear. Cool. That's actually smart. I like that one.
Thank you very much. Maybe Eliza, there's a branding. Kid raising and baby baking, we could make a swimwear for to do gender reveals around the world.
Yes.
Come to us for your gender reveals. That's right. Joe's got more ideas too.
Because also, Joe, every pregnant woman feels the most comfortable and confident in swim, don't they, Eliza?
We'd have different
especially
times.
Especially at that like 12-week period.
Yeah.
You don't know.
It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you, Micah.
Thank you, guys.
I look forward to hearing the next instalment of your birth story, which I suspect will be super, super quick.
Let's hope. Let's hope.
And super, super fun. And now, I presume you don't need to share this, but I presume you've got names sorted out for this little one.
I do. And I'll tell you a quick story if you guys want to hear, if you have time to hear it.
Yeah.
So the night that we found out the gender, we went to a restaurant, my husband, son and I. And we opened up the envelope, but I was 100,000% convinced that it was a girl. And then so when he opened it, he was like joking and he said, what does XX mean? And I was like, in my mind, it's a girl, but what is it? Tell me what it is. And he's like, it's a boy. And I was like, no, really? And I've got to say, like, it felt wrong because in my whole life, I've got a brother. So I'm a sister and a brother. And that my whole mind was like, boy and a girl, and then I'm done. So it took me a few seconds to really like comprehend. Oh my gosh, I'm going to be a boy mum of two boys. What? Like, anyway. And the restaurant we were at, actually, my husband made a joke and said, well, we better name him this name. And I was like, listen, I can't even deal with this right now. I just can't comprehend that. It's a little boy. And then that night we were researching names and that name kept popping up. It sounds good with Luca. And then the meaning, this may spoil the name if somebody wants to research it, but the meaning means gift from God. Oh, if you can hear, that's my first little one. And so when we heard that, both of us were like, oh my God, it totally is a gift from God. So that's going to be his name. And I'll tell you off air what it is.
Okay, amazing. just for anyone listening, where can they find you on social media?
So it's just at Monica with a K _ rad. And if you guys can hear Luca, he wants to join in. Yeah, Monica _ rad. That is where I share everything.
Amazing.
Best of luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Baby Baking and Kid Raising. If you'd like to suggest a guest or connect and see more of us, then head to Instagram at Baby Baking and Kid Raising. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd be so grateful if you could hit subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever listening platform you use. Please note that the information provided in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of a qualified healthcare provider regarding your own pregnancy, birth, and health conditions.